From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Like Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today on the show, we'll learn how some disastrous events at war and in the wilderness shaped a young George Washington into the man we learn about in history class.
Later, we'll talk with the people behind a Western Wisconsin soda company bubbling to the surface of a competitive industry by making it healthier than your average pop.
I don't know, there's just something that kind of makes sense to me as a human, that's the process that we want. You know, we should treat others great, and we should also treat the earth great, so that's kind of where the process comes from.
And Milwaukee musician David Fitzpatrick shares the story of his latest album, a virtual snapshot of the past 3 years of his life.
I think the biggest thing about this, I'll always remember this album to be, and there's going to be plenty more, I guarantee you that. I'm never stopping. It's closed a door and opened a new one.
Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Tomorrow is the 4th of July, the annual holiday in which we celebrate the founding of the United States. Most of us learn many of the details of our nation's founding in our history classes, from the Articles of Confederation to the Continental Congress, the Declaration of Independence, and battles such as Valley Forge and Yorktown. But while we might think we know about our founding fathers, there are large parts of their lives that aren't found in many of our history textbooks.
Writer and Wisconsin native Peter Stark knew what we all knew about George Washington. Stark's writing specialties are adventure and history, and during some time in the relatively wild reaches of western Pennsylvania, he discovered it was a place that a young George Washington had some experiences that informed the leader he became. Stark set out to learn more, and the result is his new book, Young Washington. He joins us in the studio. Welcome to the show.
Great to be here, Mitch.
Most of us probably have this image of George Washington as being kind of from this, you know, lauded, noble English family. But from what you write, that really does not seem to be the case. So what was George Washington's upbringing like and his ancestry?
He has a really interesting ancestral background. Basically, the short version is that the Washington family had been trying to climb to the upper echelons of the aristocracy for centuries, first in England and then in Virginia. And with remarkable consistency, they had not made it. The Washington men tended to marry wealthy landed widows. The men would rise in status to gentleman status. They'd have like 18 children. The wealth would disperse and they'd kind of sink back down. George Washington's great-grandfather essentially got shipwrecked in Virginia on a trading venture. Married a magistrate's daughter. Magistrate gave him 700 acres of land, you know, so here's the wealthy, fortuitous marriage. And that established the Washingtons. And so for the next four generations until George was born in 1732, they were tobacco planters at kind of middling level. And George was very ambitious to climb out of that.
That was really what sets George apart, is his ambition.
Incredible ambition. It's very notable from the time he's a teenager. And one of the things I've felt about in all my exposure to this part of his life is that his father died when he was 11. And his older brother, whom he revered, died when he was in late teens, and he was never very close to his mother. And I've thought that if his father hadn't died so young, he would have been more anchored in the world, more sure of himself, really. And so, but he was so determined to make a name for himself.
Well, and so well before he is a founding father, he is a surveyor. There is a lot of land out there with which to survey. But give us a sense for, you know, what the role of surveyors was in, you know, the 1740s and 50s.
Well, you can imagine that in the 1740s and 50s, that's basically 100 years after the Jamestown landings, a little more than that. And the British population was still very much confined to the Atlantic coast. Yet there was a huge stretch of land that lay just over the Appalachian Mountains and the Appalachian foothills and over the mountains. And George started surveying that as a teenager. So he developed very early almost a lust for land. All these Virginia planters were very much about land. And he had a real sense of acquisition for land.
Well, so from that, what is the turn of events that leads to his journey, you know, well to the Northwest to deliver a message to the French commandant in what I guess is now probably the area around Erie, Pennsylvania?
Right. And so, George, you know, when we think of coastal the Atlantic and coastal Virginia, so that's where the British colonies are, of course, the colonies that we know. And then up in Canada, there were the French, and they had, you know, their colony there that dated back to the early 1600s also. So in between was a huge area known as the Ohio wilderness. And it's not just the Ohio we think of today, not the state. It would encompass Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, Pennsylvania, Virginia, on and on and on. It's an area almost the size of France. So in the about 1753, George had just, as a 21-year-old, signed up to be a young officer in the Virginia militia as another way to advance his standing and his career. And he was still surveying, and he had was doing a little planting. And he signed up for this job and this post. And at that point, just then, the British governor of Virginia, Virginia Colony, of course, Governor Dinwiddie, heard that the French were building forts out in the vast Ohio wilderness. And Governor Dinwiddie needed someone to deliver a message to the French, basically saying, stay out, all these lands belong to King George. George Washington raised his hand. He had some frontier experience. Governor Dinwiddie dispatched him and sent him over the Appalachian Mountains in late 1753 with a wilderness guide, Christopher Gist. They hit terrible snowstorms crossing the mountains. They were on horseback. They had servants. They got way back into the wilderness after a terrible journey, and they came to a French post. It was greeted by a French officer who said, oh, man, you're in the wrong place, and kind of brushed George off. And remember, George is only 21 years old, and he has no military experience. Very ambitious, and brushes him off, says, oh, you got to ride a week that way to my boss. And so George and Gist and their party do, and through, you know, swamps and mud and rain and snow and on, and get to a larger French post recently built, and there is a distinguished gentleman, elderly gentleman soldier, French commandant, who greets George with, you know, the formal dinner and candlelight and red wine, which is imported from France, and wonderful meats, and the whole formal greeting, and then reads the letter and goes into another room and writes a reply and sends George off. And George goes thrashing back through the wilderness at high speed because Governor Dinwiddie has told him to go with all urgency. And George ends up leaving his horses, which are failing because they can't find enough feed in the snow, and the streams are frozen, and he almost dies falling off a raft into a river, and all these incredible, harrowing adventures. It's amazing he made it. And he gets back to Governor Dinwiddie and hands him the letter, and the letter says, from the French commandant, well, our nations are finally at peace. You know, this is after they've been at war for 700 years, and I would very much like to keep the peace. However, as to your request that I should leave, I don't think so. And that's where the real trouble begins.
Well, and what's interesting, a lot of it is interesting, but, you know, of all the people to take on this mission, this is a guy that, you know, he had some frontier experience, but he was not a wilderness expert.
He was not. No.
Not a diplomacy expert either.
Neither of those things. I mean, George starts whining when he first goes into the wilderness that there are no linen tablecloths on the tables of the frontier settlers in their log cabins, and their table manners are terrible. They just eat with a knife, and their bed bugs, and blah, blah, blah. So he has, you know, he's learning. And so he has at first very little wilderness experience and no military experience, and that really gets him into a great deal of trouble when Governor Dinwiddie, having read this letter, sends him back into the wilderness at the head of a small military party and to essentially deliver a firmer message to the French. And Governor Dinwiddie warns George, do not be the aggressor and be cautious. George, in his naked ambition, proceeds to do exactly the opposite. He ends up ambushing a small party of French who are having breakfast in a wooded glen on a rainy dawn, and George and his men open fire, and they end up killing a number of these French. George takes the rest of the French prisoner, about 20, 25 prisoners, and you'd think at this point a sensible commander would pause, that this did not go exactly as planned. But George doesn't. He just brazenly pushes ahead, and he's very cocky. He says, well, if the French can put up no more fight than this, I'll drive them back to damn Montreal. And he writes to his brother, I mean, really right after this terrible incident, he writes to his brother and says, I heard bullets whistling, and believe me, there's something charming in the sound. And eventually that got back to King George, who responded, he would not say so if he'd heard many. But what happens is that George ends up getting essentially slaughtered by the French and the Indians and has to surrender, and terrible experience. And this is what touches off the French and Indian War.
How does the transformation take place then from this cocky guy who really, you know, believes a lot in himself without necessarily having the wisdom and the experience to back it up, to a guy who really does come up with the gravitas that one needs to become the commander of the Continental Army?
You know, it's a great question and a really interesting transformation. There are several key moments and events, and the patterns that I see is that he first, instead of being so self-promoting, just remarkably self-promoting and ambitious and whiny and petulant, complaining about officers who are ranked above him and not enough pay, and he's underappreciated and he's going to quit. He threatens to quit 7 times and quits some of them. It goes on and on like that. But he eventually gets put in charge of the Virginia regiment, almost 1,000 men at age 23, very young. And he's responsible for protecting these frontier settlers over a 350-mile-long frontier, which I compare to the Afghanistan-Pakistan frontier of today, an almost impossible task to defend. Through this process, he sees his own men get slaughtered and lying dead in mud and blood in trenches. And, you know, these guys who are his age, who he's been responsible for, who's, you know, he's marched them into this situation, and now they're lying dead all around him. And you see George's sense of empathy start to grow, first towards the men he's leading. And he's also very good about at a certain point, he shifts over and he literally at one point gets down off his horse. And, you know, that's a big thing for a Virginia gentleman to do. And he starts, you know, kind of getting down in the mud and pushing cannons up mountainsides with his men. And, you know, really he really gets down there in the dirt with them, which is they really bond with that. And then there's no sense that no doubt that he has whatsoever, that he has this incredible bravery. You know, he is utterly fearless. No one ever doubted that about him from the very beginning. And incredibly fortunate at the same time for what he survives. So at one point the British finally do send a big army of redcoats into the wilderness under General Braddock, it's a famous incident in colonial history. They get ambushed by the Indians and the French. They don't even see the Indians. You know, they're behind trees and they just drop like flies in the middle of the road.
Traditional rules of engagement not applying.
Yeah, here. And the general is marching along saying, "Well, there's and the officers are saying, "Well, we can't have a battle here. There's no place to have a battle. So why would we worry?" And of course, the Indians. That's what they do. They fight in that terrain, and it's just, again, terrible slaughter of hundreds and hundreds. And George is kind of the last officer standing. It's called Braddock's Defeat, this famous battle. And he's a young aide-de-camp to General Braddock, and he rides around delivering messages from the general who's wounded. And George has horses shot out from under him, and then at the end of the battle, he looks at his hat and his coat. And he has 4 bullet holes through his hat and his coat. And he immediately, again, you know, his response to that is he writes a letter to his brother and says, divine providence protected me beyond all human expectation. And at that moment, you know, through that event, one really gets a sense that George starts seeing a larger role for himself, that he's being protected for a reason. And then I think the final thing that's really marked to me is that when he finally does leave the wilderness at age 26 and the British finally pry the French and Indians out of there, George immediately quits. He wants to go back to being a planter. He quits. Within a few weeks of leaving the wilderness, he marries Martha, who's what else? The richest widow in Virginia, who has 17,000 acres of land and dozens and dozens and dozens of slaves, which, you know, of course, is a form of wealth in that those days, that society. And his marriage to Martha instantly brings him up to the top of the Virginia aristocracy. So he doesn't have to worry about his social status anymore. He doesn't really have to worry so much about money. And then I think even more important that Martha gives him this sense of emotional reassurance, and that which he didn't have growing up as a younger man, as an adolescent, as a youth, and George kind of settles down. He becomes a planter for almost 15 years, and then we get into the story that we know is that this French and Indian War, which is spread around the globe, known as the Seven Years' War, which started right with George Washington's musket and orders right there. This war finally ends in 1763. 2 years later, in 1765, the British say, "We spent so much money protecting you American colonists. We're feeling really broke, so we're going to put this tax on you guys, the Stamp Act." It causes huge uproar in the colonies, and then the British revoke it, that they add more taxes later, and we know the story from there. Meanwhile, George is Virginia planter, prosperous, and he's a Virginia like a legislator. And when things really start heating up, there are the Continental Congresses, and George is a representative from Virginia, one of several, and he goes to the Continental Congress held in May and June of 1775, right after the battles of Lincoln and Concord. The Continental Congress is putting together an army to march against the British in Boston, and they look around the room there in Philadelphia and say, "Who's going to lead this thing?" And you got short John Adams there, and like a lawyer, a mouthy lawyer from Boston, and he's not a wilderness guy.
Not really a recipe for success, no.
And people look around the room, and there's this quiet, tall guy who carries himself with a sort of regal bearing, who knew the gift of silence. And George has always had a thing for uniforms. So he's recently designed a new officer's uniform for the county militia down in Fairfax County. And George at the Continental Congress is sitting there silently with this regal bearing and wearing this incredibly beautiful officer's uniform with all the gewgaws and spangles and braids. And people look over and say, "There's our guy." So unanimously, they choose him to be our first commander in chief.
And amazing to think of this guy who was petulant and threatened to quit seven times as being the same guy who in whatever it was, the 1790s, steps down from the presidency for the good of the country.
Exactly. I think, that this image that we have of George Washington, that I think it's actually done the image that we've propagated in history, I think it's really done a big disservice to Americans, and especially younger Americans, that we have the sense of this, guy who's born, selfless, faultless judgment, flawless, a sort of an immaculately conceived man god who arrives on the scene and he leads, the colonies to independence and becomes the first president. And that's not the way it happened at all. I mean, he thrashed and he struggled and he made mistakes and he failed, but he learned from them. And so this more vulnerable, more accessible George Washington is one that I find far more inspirational than this distant statue that we have. And I also think it's a real example both for youth and, we talk about today, in our country, in our Congress, worldwide, enormous crisis of leadership. And here's an example of someone who started out very flawed And he worked at it. He worked at it. He overcame it. And he became this great, and he was this selfless leader who stepped down saying, I don't want to be king. I just want to make this country work. And then he stepped down.
One of those cases where the true story is actually far more interesting and far better than the myth.
It's true, yes. I think exactly that, that the true story, it has so much more of a human component, and it's one that I think that we as flawed mortal citizens with all our weaknesses can relate to a lot better than this guy who just strides on the scene and magically leads things to this incredible place.
Peter Stark, it's a great story, and you tell it so well. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Mitch. It's been really fun.
Peter Stark's latest book is called Young Washington: How Wilderness and War Forged America's Founding Father. Stark grew up around Pine Lake in Waukesha County, but now calls Montana home.
A short break now, and then an unlikely soda success story from small town Wisconsin. Keep listening. Lake Effect continues in a moment on WUWM.
One last time. From me one last time, and if we get this right,
might as well go for a soda. Nobody hurts and nobody cries.
Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Mitch Teich. As we prepare for the 4th of July holiday, I bet you've got a lot of items still on your grocery list for the picnic or the family cookout you might be having. One thing you want to have on hand on a hot summer day is a cooler full of beverages, from water to beer to soda or pop, perhaps.
What do you call it out east?
I call everything Coke.
Well, I prefer soda, but soda is a beverage that's been around since the 1800s and is probably something we take for granted today. But when was the last time you actually thought about how your soda was made?
Turns out Austin Ashley has put a lot of thought into it. Ashley has had a lifelong obsession with beverages, and he knew that he could make a better drink out of his kitchen compared to what he typically found at a gas station or when he was at the movies.
So in the early 2000s, Ashley started brewing soda out of his kitchen, starting with small batch ginger beers, and demand from his friends and family soon turned a hobby into a business. In 2012, Ashley and his wife launched Wisco Pop in Viroqua, Wisconsin. He stopped by the Lake Effect studio on a recent trip to Milwaukee to share his knowledge and love of soda. Austin Ashley, welcome to Lake Effect.
Well, thanks for having me.
So I feel like most consumers, we take soda for granted. You know, it's something that's always been there on the shelves in the superstore, at the theaters. You know, you pour it and you don't think about it and you enjoy it. But what made you look at soda and say, I can do this better?
Yeah, I think you made a great point and distinction that is what I set out to do, was create something I could make in my own kitchen. I'd worked in culinary and was just more interested in creating my own beverages. And so take stuff to a potluck and people are like, wow, this is really good. And it's like, you know, using the word soda has been kind of even difficult in our business.
Right, Wisco Pop, yet soda. So what's your preference?
Well, yeah. Right, my preference, and I'm from Texas, so they call it Coke.
Okay.
So that's pretty funny. But
yeah,
just more like the dynamic of soda being kind of like a not-so-good-for-you product. Whereas in everything that we do, we're actually juicing, or, you know, if we're making a strawberry soda, then it's a pound of strawberries per gallon. So we brew the strawberry versus, you know, some kind of artificial strawberry flavor. That's what makes it great.
You mentioned the word brewing a soda, which
yeah,
I wouldn't think of automatically when it comes to making soda. So just to break it down for us, what is the actual process of making your product?
Yeah, so we come in on Monday, we fire up our kettles and fill them with water. So if we're making the strawberry soda, we'll fill that with over 475 pounds of strawberries. And, you know, just let it brew for probably about 2 to 3 hours and extract all the essence and juice out of that. Then we pull it from there and transfer it through a heat exchanger, which cools it down to about a temperature of 65, and then into a bright tank, which is like a conditioning tank they use in the beer world. And then that will cool it down to about 32 to 34 degrees, which is optimal carbonation temperature. The liquid needs to be really cold for the CO2 to actually adhere to the beverage, or else, I don't know, you've probably had a soda before where you taste it and it's like, this tastes like gas, or, you know, too much carbonation. So, right. So the slow process that we focus on, putting the bubbles in slowly, allows it to have a more flavorful experience.
So do you think, or are you aware of the process, say, a Coke manufacturer uses?
Yeah.
Are they doing this differently?
Yeah, I would say so. You know, we're kind of this grassrootsy thing, taking the whole ingredients versus Coca-Cola is just like the syrup that's getting injected. I mean, we run like, I think, 36 bottles a minute or something like that. And, you know, Coca-Cola is like, that's just a machine. That thing kicks out probably 1,000 a minute or something like that. I don't know. I've watched some of these rotary fillers and they're pretty impressive.
Right.
But it's also, it's impressive, but it's also disconnected from what I think is food.
Well, getting on that idea of food being in your beverage, you know, you have flavors like the strawberry you mentioned, cherry, ginger, and it's a big difference where you can tell this isn't syrup. So with the importance of food, why did this grip you in that way to highlight food versus I'm highlighting my beverage product?
Yeah, the food aspect, I just recently went and visited the chef I started with in 1999, and he just really pushed me into the direction of using whole ingredients, and he would talk about the local sustainable movement, or local agrarian movement is what he called it. And I was like, I don't even know what that means. At the time, I was like 19, and we grew our own produce there. I don't know, there's just something that kind of makes sense to me as a human, that that's the process that we want. You know, we should treat others great, and we should also treat the earth great. So that's kind of where the process comes from.
Well, most people wouldn't think that a local food movement is a big factor into making soda.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, like, you know, where do you get your strawberries? What are your parameters in what you consider? How are we supporting those around us?
Right, right. The big thing for us is the local part of it is really hard to stress in Wisconsin with fruits, right? So we don't work with necessarily – we do work with Snowpack, which is a producer in Minnesota, which – anyway, we buy our strawberries from them. But as far as it comes with juice and stuff like that for lemons and limes, they do come from California. We started with juicing every single lime and lemon by hand. Then we bought a juicer. Then we bought another juicer that was bigger, can go faster. And now we actually just buy juice in that is produced at these manufacturing plants. So that's kind of been a big leap in our business, but it was something that I gradually grew us to also with knowing, like you're saying, where it's coming from, knowing how it's processed is really important to us. And I think also to our end consumer.
Well, on the note of consumers, do you think there is a greater awareness and a greater want of having more products in your home and your fridge that are local? Because, you know, water, mm-hmm. we can get it from Lake Michigan. We can also buy bottled mm-hmm. water. I feel like consuming local is not as prevalent for non-alcoholic beverages.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would think so. I think the thing that's really important in the local foods thing is these vegetable farmers that aren't getting paid and that kind of stuff. You know, I don't think that that really goes into the sector that we're in. I think it's important that we're creating something that is good for the earth and good for your body versus the other. You know, I think that's the best way I could put it.
With craft beer exploding into such a large scene, do you think you're better able to compete in a non-alcoholic market? Because you did have a background in brewing beer as well.
Right. Well, the thing with the non-alcoholic thing is like, man, that you think craft beer is big. I mean, the beverage world. I mean, how many coffee cold brews are there out there? I mean, I'm sure you're more than aware. It's ubiquitous. So the category of beverage, places are dedicating like 24 feet. To beverage. So it's getting really competitive, and it's not competitive with somebody who's small like me under $1 million in sales. It's with these big 50 million to way larger.
Yeah. And what do you think your advantages are running Wisco Pop in this big world?
I think what the advantage is, I get to have a good life and I get to employ people to have a good life as well. And that's kind of something I stay focused on. You know, I think that part of sustainability isn't always taken into. You know, we look at the environment and stuff, but what about the environment that we give to other people?
Soda, to me, it was always something that I could have right. sporadically. Like, okay, it's a family
you had good
party.
Parents.
Yeah. Family party. Yes, you can have one soda, you know.
Right.
So it was, it's always something that I've not had very often. And
right.
and now in this point in my life, it's usually, okay, I'll have like a whiskey and a ginger ale or something, but it's right. it's not something that to sit and savor with. Are you trying to make it such that this can be that experience for people?
Yeah, I think it should be. I hope this calls to what you're asking, but I think it should be a more of a sensual experience, like dessert. You know, it's like, I don't eat. Okay, I have eaten more than one pint of ice cream in a week. But the thing is like, it's just not my life. Like, I don't even like trying to sell to people. I'm not trying to capture that soda consumer that's addicted and trying to drink soda every day. I'm trying to give a better opportunity for people to have something that they can enjoy and savor versus just having a whoop-de-doo experience with 95 cents or whatever.
Right.
Yeah.
And also on the health note, you mentioned this is pure products, and you also do sodas and sparkles. And you also took the step to make your products organic.
Right.
A lot of companies might be hesitant to do so because there are more production costs and things that can factor in
sure.
down the road. But
yeah.
What was the importance of doing that for your company?
Well, yeah, and it kind of comes back to we were working, actually initially Wisco Pop started out doing a local honey sweetened soda. But as I kind of kept digging through it, I found that they were actually feeding the bees corn syrup. And I thought, well, that's exactly what we're trying to get away from. We're trying to get away from GMO corn syrup. We're trying to get away from, I don't have a better way to put it, but that's just what we're trying to get away from. We just kind of took a step back and said, well, look at this, like, you know, 65% of our product is already organic just because we do it. And we don't add that value in front of the customer and say, you know, it's USDA organic. We just offer it out. So now, like, let's look at this and say, well, what's a part of our value? And that's kind of what we did, was we decided to restructure it and say, let's become USDA organic because we can, we trust that. And I have this like internal sense of that if I'm 85% there, 80 to 85% there, if I go to a good church and it's 80 to 85% there, I'm doing pretty good. You know, nothing is 100%, you know. I think that the system's kind of rigged that way. So then we're never satisfied. But so if I can always get into 80% and I feel like being USDA organic puts us to that 80%, and I'm very happy with it.
Do you have any favorite soda memories growing up?
I do. I remember looking over at my mom, and we go to the butcher shop every week and go pick up the meat. I got a dad's root beer, and I remember tasting it and just thinking, like, I'd like to do that. And that's kind of a funny thing that has come up over the years where it's like, huh, maybe I had this innate capacity to be like, oh, yeah, that would be fun. And it has been fun.
And it's always kind of harking back to you no matter
yeah.
which direction you've gone in.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And it's always been beverage specific. My granny, that's a really good story, is that my granny, they grew produce in their yard, okra, tomatoes, corn, so forth. And I grew up in South Texas, and they had mangoes and papayas and fig trees, all kinds of stuff. And one day I came to her house, and she's, hey, darling, I've got this limeade I made for you. And she had pressed all these little poquito limes, little small limes. And it was so delicious. I drank that whole half gallon by myself. But, you know, just that, you know, always kind of having a sense for beverage and really enjoying it. It's just, I think everybody enjoys beverages, right?
I think we need to perhaps harken back to starting to savor our beverages more.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, right. And especially for, we're in Wisconsin, which is the beer capital
yeah.
of everything. But to have that option open to people,
right.
that you can still have a great drink and be with people and socialize without consuming alcohol.
Oh, sure, yeah. Or we can add alcohol to it.
Exactly. But has that ever been a factor with making quality non-alcoholic beverages? Like, was there anyone in your life who decided to give up drinking, or was it just a factor that you wanted to make available to more people?
Well, I actually don't drink. So that's been part of my process, is that that's kind of part of how it had come about, was that I was going to places to hang out with people, and, you know, I didn't have anything to drink. But I show up with something that everybody can drink, kids, mom-in-law, dad, all that stuff. So it's always been kind of important to me to, like, show up with something. And now that I have a business, I just always show up with. It's kind of the lazy way to show up to a potluck. You'd be like, yeah, I already got
the beverages covered.
You guys like strawberry or grapefruit?
Yeah.
You're more of a sparkle kind of person.
Got you covered. Well, on that note, why don't we make some of your favorite kind of cocktails with Wisco Pop?
Yeah, you bet.
All right. What drink are we setting up here?
Yeah, so we're going to do like a kind of a little spicy Paloma grapefruit, which our newest product is grapefruit soda, which is Texas Ruby Red grapefruit juice, limes, and sugar. So I'm going to chop up a little jalapeno. And then a little bit of cilantro in there for you. And we'll do 1.5 ounces of some tequila. And then we're doing about 5 ounces of grapefruit soda. Little, you know, whatever you think you can take on the old, on the jalapeno side. You know, it's not for everybody.
Yeah.
But it's just enough to where you're...
Yeah, being a Midwestern, I can handle some heat, but not a lot.
Right. A little bit of cilantro in there. And then put it over ice for you. Oh, yeah. Just don't eat the jalapeno, I guess. Okay. Should
Excellent.
Do. You want to give it a shot? I don't know.
Yeah.
See if it's high octane.
Cheers.
My business partner told me this is the one he uses.
It's really good. And the grapefruit is coming up after, you know?
Like yeah.
It's good, subtle.
Here, give this a shot on its own and see what the difference is. Just kind of depth of acidity and a little bit.
And that is good. And I have to say, I don't enjoy grapefruit just on its own. So
Yeah. Yeah.
But in here, it's really pleasant. It's not, you know, digging into a grapefruit with a spoon. And
right.
Yeah.
I think one thing to note is that they're Texas Rio Reds, which is a different variety. They're less bitter. They just have more complexity to them. They're kind of sweeter. I really like them.
Yeah. And a little nod to your hometown, I'm sure.
Yeah, pretty much. It's probably about an hour and a half from where I'm from.
Okay.
Yeah.
Excellent.
I'm pretty close. I was pretty close to the border growing up.
Very tasty.
Thank you.
What other kind of summer drinks do you enjoy, personally?
Without anything in it, I love drinking lemon sparkle, which I think I brought you some samples to try. Or lemon or lime sparkle, which is just, it's just lime, it's just lemon, it's just water with really great carbonation in it.
Austin Ashley is the CEO of Wisco Pop. You can find more information about the company, where to find the soda in your area, and recipes for summer cocktails at WUWM.com.
One more break, and then an in-studio chat and an acoustic take on new music from Milwaukee's David Fitzpatrick. This is Lake Effect from WUWM.
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. David Fitzpatrick has been on the Milwaukee music scene for quite some time as the frontman for his David Fitzpatrick Band. But a few years ago, things started slowing down for Fitzpatrick. Several of the members of the band moved or drifted away from the band, and life circumstances brought things to almost a standstill.
But Fitzpatrick never gave up the dream or the business, and after a songwriting and recording effort that lasted several years, the fruits of his work are just out, an album called Parachutes in Hurricanes. Fitzpatrick and producer Gary Tannen stopped by the Lake Effect studio recently to talk about the origin story of the new record. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for having us.
Pleasure to be here.
Was there a story you were hoping to tell with this new album?
Yeah, to me it felt like a soundtrack, but you know, I really don't know what the theme is. Like,
you say a soundtrack to what?
Concept album. Yeah, a soundtrack to what, you know? Because I had a lot of things going on at the time. I was taking care of my folks. My dad passed away through part of it, and that was a big moment for me to say, you know, look, like he said, time's wasting. You know, if you're going to do this, you got to concentrate on it and put everything into it. You know, the other albums were all done in my basement, and they're great. You know, I'm proud of them and everything, but I really wanted somebody else on this. I wanted horns. I wanted a feel. But a lot of the songs ended up being about what's been going on the past 3 years, in subtle ways, you know?
Right. You say life gets in the way, but without that life, you don't
exactly.
have material.
That's the lesson learned. This album was, for lack of a better word, therapeutic, you know, for that and in that matter. And it also was a lot of it was written in real time, which is really interesting because there's a lot of times I came in, I'm pulling in Gary's driveway and I'm like, he's going to kill me because I don't have this next verse. But I'd go in there and we'd start talking and then we'd start doing it and it would just start coming out. So the fun part of that album is so much of that is written at the moment of recording, not something that's predestined. You know, this took shape in there, and it took shape as all these events are happening, and this time is becoming too long.
So when you look back at this record, you know, 10 years from now, it really is a snapshot of that point in your life.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I think the biggest thing about this, I'll always remember this album to be, and there's going to be plenty more, I guarantee you that. I'm never stopping. It's closed a door and opened a new one.
Gary, as the producer of a record as it's being made in this way, do you have to balance the writing in real time with wanting to polish it as well?
Oh, absolutely. But I realized early on with Dave, in the process of selecting the songs, you know, Dave would give me demos and I'd say, Dave, that's a snippet of a chorus. And he says, yeah, but I just say whatever words come to my. I said, Dave, that's not going to work. You know, so but the challenge was I listened to the first two songs and I listened to the poetry and I said, I don't care how this happens. This guy did this. So I'm not worried so much. It was a challenge because normally I don't work writing in the studio. I have done some of that, but it's mostly been on my own material where I'm in the process and I'll change lyrics or I won't have lyrics. So I'm used to that process, but not with another artist this deeply.
It worked for Lennon and McCartney from what I gather in the
yeah.
early
yeah,
days.
Yeah, well, and you know, we don't have that long term of a relationship, but I have been, put it this way, it was natural for me to be helping with the writing at that side of it. Because it allowed for Dave to express this material in a way that would have never happened any other way.
Right. Well, I right? agree. Yeah, that's what made it interesting, very interesting. You know,
the cliche, you know, capturing lightning in a bottle here.
Right.
I mean, you
right.
know,
and it's Grace Under Pressure. For some reason, it takes that. That sounds probably maybe a bit immature about it, but it really takes Grace Under Pressure with me. There's plenty of times, and I'm not just going to put anything. If I don't feel it, you know, I have more respect for my listeners than to throw something out that I'm not feeling. You know, why would I expect them to, you know?
Well, I feel like at this point we you know we heard some from the record going into the interview, but you brought your guitar along
yes,
into the studio.
Yes,
we
definitely.
Would love to hear something as interpreted acoustically today.
Fantastic. Great.
Tell us what you're going to play.
Well, I'm going to play If I Could. This was a song that I wrote quite a while ago and always had it around and didn't know if it was going to be fitting for the album, but once Gary heard it and we thought, yeah, it'll be a nice contrast to some of the other stuff. So it's been around for a while, which is nice to see it on the album because it's new to everybody. If I could turn back time, I'd gather up your sorrow, throw it right out of your mind. You'd forget it tomorrow, you'd be so free from anything that ever made you cry. If I could, oh, if I could, I. If I could take your smile and paint it on the mirror, I'd wake up every day in style. You'd be so much nearer, I'd be so free from ever thinking life had passed me by. If I could, oh, if I could,
I'd be that sail that brings you in ashore. I'd be that warmth that always gives you more. Oh, I'd be that secret place you love to hide.
If I could, David Fitzpatrick in the Lake Effect studio. Thank you so much. What a great song.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much.
Tell us a little bit about the guitar you played that on, because there is a story behind it.
Yeah, it's a Taylor. I had it for a very long time. I used to have these really kind of cheap acoustics, you know, which are wonderful, you know. But I started recording in my basement, kind of built my own studio. And boy, when you listen back to them, it was a nightmare, you know, to get a good sound. And I was at the store and I saw that and begged, borrowed, and stole to get it. You know, it's expensive, but it stays in tune. And I was basically, we were a rock band at the time, you know, a little heavier. I had two guitar players. So I brought that acoustic and I just played acoustic and they play the electric. And I started really beating the heck out of it and was upset about all the dings that was getting it until I realized, you know what, that's seasoning it.
Character marks.
Yeah, it stays in tune all the time. It's cherished, that one.
How long does it take for a guitar to feel like your guitar?
Not long. The first couple dings that you get upset about, then it's your guitar, you know. I have a Telecaster at home. Fender Telecaster was my first guitar that I ever had, and that's my prized possession. It's heavy for any guitar players out there. It's the Fender in the old days, so it's like a 1979, and it's a lead ball around your neck, you know. But everybody, and it's beat. I mean, it gets beat up, but boy, every guitar player out there who sees it just says, hey, when are you getting rid of that? That one? Never, never. If the house was burning, that'd be the first thing I'd grab.
You were saying that, you know, for a long time you played on cheap acoustics your basement.
You could get your hands on, yeah.
Yeah. When you listen back to the stuff that you recorded years ago, what has stuck with you that shows up on this album? And what have you kind of gotten past?
Well, that's a great question because that actually happened recently. I have, I think I counted last 120 90-minute tapes full of material at home, bits and pieces, maybe not complete or anything else.
And for our younger listeners, tapes are these things that we used to record things on.
I used to have a little Walkman.
Yes, exactly.
And I always had to have a recordable Walkman because that's how I get all my notes. You know, I kind of write sporadically like that. And it was fun to listen to it. There's certain nuances in singing and feel that I still have. But the beauty of it is to when you're kind of down or things maybe not going strong enough, you're not really seeing the results that you've accomplished. You listen to this old stuff and realize how far I've graduated as a writer, how good I've gotten at being me. My goal was always, you know, it's not technically how well you write as much as you have to be you. When you're able to interpret you to other people and do it clearly and honestly, that's when things really happen. That's when people feel it. You know, you never underestimate listeners. And I noticed that that's starting to come across much better. It's fun to have that comparison.
I would just add to that clearly the only, you know, if you have a barometer at all, the kinds of critical review we've gotten on this record has all been just tremendous.
Outstanding.
I mean, 4 and 5 star reviews, European blogs, you know, making...
Looked like a nice review in Belgium, I saw.
Yeah, that was excellent. And it compared him to early Bob Seger, which was interesting because I didn't hear that while we were recording
it. I wonder if references like that are a surprise when you hear them.
Well, they make a lot... When someone nails it and you go, yeah, then they make a lot of sense. And Dave Lurson from the Shepherd Express made that comparison. I thought it was like, you know, it had the sensibility of Van Morrison in kind of the and maybe some of the Irish punk bands the gravity of the poetry. And that's what attracted me. But I can see the comparison to Bob Seger.
Well, so let me ask you both this question, and I'm kind of curious to get, you know, both musician and producer's take on this. Is there a moment that maybe might otherwise pass people by on this album that you would really want people to be aware of?
Yeah, there's a certain feel that happened. I'd love for them to be aware of getting their own interpretation of this. This is a lot about disillusionment. It's not to be meant as a negative album or a downer. It's there's disillusionment in the world. And the one thing that I learned is, like, Lost on the Same Street is very much a unity song. Look, there's disillusionment. You know, you get older and certain things don't happen the way planned and what was going on, what I was seeing in my life and everything else. But the whole theme of it is, yeah, that's happening and that's the world, but you're not alone.
And Gary?
I would say, and I thought you would say this too, David, and I think once I say it, you're going to say, oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah, that, yeah.
The song Done to Me.
Yeah.
It came at the end. It was written, again, completely in the studio, and it is like the bookend to the whole project. It's like all of these storylines and comparisons and not-alones that happened throughout the record, and... you know, I gotta say that the wealth of musicians, local musicians that we had on here, that were all excellent. Jack Spann, the fact that we recorded at Tanner Monagle Studios was upscaled everything. But ultimately, when we ended up with that last song that I went in and actually played grand piano on, there's a tenderness and a longing and a languor about that that just every time I hear it, I just go. It just leaves me with this kind of melancholy sadness, but almost gotten through it kind of thing. And I think after all of the songs on the record, it's kind of this...
David Fitzpatrick's new album is called Parachutes in Hurricanes. It's produced by Milwaukee's Gary Tannen. We spoke with both of them recently, and you can find more about the album at WUWM.com. And David Fitzpatrick takes us out for today's edition of the show. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for tuning in today. Tomorrow, Lake Effect gives way for the Capitol Steps Independence Day Politics Takes a Holiday special. I hope you can join us for that Wednesday at 10 on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Stay tuned. Fresh Air is next.
Just to forgive and forget, but there's a price I paid.